France's claim of a genocide in the country.
Yeah. Donald Trump and Elon Musk said about discrimination and genocide in South Africa?
Well, Donald Trump, first of all, he defended his decision of giving Afrikaners refugee status.
Right.
Trump said a genocide was taking place in South Africa. White farmers were being brutally killed, in his words, and their land was being confiscated, in his words. But South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, actually visited the White House, visited Washington.
Right, yeah.
In May of this year, he met with President Trump at the White House, and he said, it is completely false. Cyril Ramaphosa said, it is completely false to claim that people of a certain race or culture are being targeted for persecution in his country.
Yeah.
Cyril Ramaphosa also referred to a group of white South Africans who have obtained a visa because the United States is giving them preferential treatment. White South Africans are being given visas quite easily by the federal government in the United States. President Ramaphosa said, these white South Africans are leaving the country because they don't want to embrace the changes that are currently taking place in our country and in South Africa's constitution. So President Ramaphosa, who was in the White House in May of this year, he was kind of taken by surprise when Donald Trump played a video in the Oval Office. Trump played a video which claimed was proof of a genocide in South Africa. The video included an opposition politician in South Africa singing a song that some say evokes violence against white South Africans. But President Ramaphosa, he actually brought with him a number of white South African golfers to the meeting with Trump because Donald Trump owns several golf courses and he's a golf enthusiast.
Yeah,
he's actually a golf player himself.
Yeah.
But President Ramaphosa condemned what was shown in the video, and he explained to Donald Trump that in South Africa, there is a law of free expression, so the South Africans are free to express whatever they feel or whatever they like to say. But Trump also showed him photos of white people which he said had been murdered in South Africa. But President Ramaphosa reminded President Trump that crime in South Africa is a very high murder rate, in particular murder in South Africa has a very high rate. And the majority of victims of murder are black people, but some white people do get murdered as well. So that was President Ramaphosa's response. At this White House meeting in May of this year, we had Trump's close advisor at the time, Elon Musk. Elon Musk, of course, himself is a South African. He was born in South Africa and he lived in South Africa until he was 18 years old. Now, Elon Musk referred to South Africa's racist ownership laws, alleging that his satellite internet service provider Starlink was not allowed to operate in South Africa simply because, he said, I'm not black. So the reason why the South African government is not allowing me to operate Starlink in South Africa because I'm white. That's what he was saying. So to operate in South Africa, Starlink needs to obtain network and service licenses, which both require 30% ownership by historically disadvantaged groups in South Africa. And this mainly means the majority black population of South Africa who were shut out of the country's economy during the long years of apartheid. But the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa, a regulatory body in telecommunications and broadcasting, said Starlink has never submitted an application for a license in South Africa. So Elon Musk was claiming he's being effectively discriminated against in South Africa because he's white. But the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa, the regulatory body for broadcasting and telecommunications, said Starlink, or Elon Musk, has never actually submitted an application for a license to operate in South Africa. And another accusation which Elon Musk made was that he accused the Economic Freedom Fighters, the fourth largest political party in South Africa, of actively promoting a genocide of white people through a song which members of this political party sing at their rallies.
Earlier this year, Secretary of State Marco Rubio boycotted a G20 meeting for foreign ministers because its agenda focused on diversity, inclusion, and climate change efforts. Tell us more about that.
Yes, well, Secretary of State Marco Rubio skipped a two-day meeting of foreign ministers of the G20 group that took place in February of this year after criticizing the host South Africa's policies as anti-American. Now, top European diplomats, as well as The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, they all attended the G20 Foreign Ministers meeting in Johannesburg, South Africa in February of this year. Marco Rubio's absence reflects the Trump administration's indifference to organizations promoting international cooperation. But Rubio said that the reason he didn't attend was that South Africa's priorities for its presidency of G20 were not his priorities. He said South Africa has placed solidarity, equality and sustainability as the theme of this year's G20 meeting. And Rubio posted on Twitter, on X, he said that the reason he has not attended the meeting of the foreign ministers, he said, my job is to advance America's national interests, not waste taxpayer money or cuddle anti-Americanism.
Yeah.
So that's the reason he gave for not attending the meeting.
I see. What do South African crime statistics tell us about murder in South Africa?
Yes, as we mentioned earlier, murder rate in South Africa is very high. South Africa is one of those countries where a lot of murders take place, unfortunately. So South African crime statistics do not show that white South Africans or Afrikaners or Boers, as they're called, are being targeted in any systematic or genocidal way. The overall murder rate in South Africa is high, but the majority of victims of murder in South Africa are black, not white Afrikaners.
Right. You are listening to the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran, English Radio. This program entitled, That Was the Week That Was. Now, why does a political party in South Africa sing about shooting white farmers?
Yes, this is a good question, and Elon Musk actually mentioned this when President Cyril Ramaphosa met Donald Trump at the White House, and Elon Musk was present at that meeting as well. He mentioned this special song, which is sang by the fourth largest political party in South Africa, the EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters.
I see.
Now, the leader of this political party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, is a man called Julius Malema. Julius Malema, he has a trademark song, and the EFF members of this political party always sing this song during their political meetings, Shoot the Boer, Shoot the Farmer. So the song is called Shoot the Boer or Shoot the Farmer.
Yeah.
And they always sing this song at political rallies. Now, the Afrikaner, the white South African lobby groups have tried to get this song banned in the courts of law, saying it was highly inflammatory and it amounted to hate speech against white South Africans. But South Africa's Supreme Court of Appeal has ruled that Julius Malema and the EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters, Julius Malema is within his rights to sing the lyrics of this song. The song goes back actually to the time of the apartheid regime. It's an old song. It was first popularized during the struggle against apartheid, you know, 4 decades ago. So it's an old song, about half a century old. It's about 50 years old.
Yeah.
And it was popular to sing it when the apartheid system was in South Africa. And the Supreme Court of South Africa ruled that a reasonably well-informed person would understand that when protest songs are sung, even by politicians, the words are not meant to be understood literally, nor is the gesture of shooting to be understood as a call to arms or violence. Instead, the song was a provocative way of advancing the EFF's political agenda, which was to end land and economic injustice in South Africa. So that was the court ruling. So effectively, the Supreme Court of South Africa ruled that Julius Malema, the leader of South Africa's fourth largest political party, EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters, was within his right to sing this song at the political rallies. He was within his right, so he had the right to sing this song.
I see. And do white people face discrimination in South Africa?
Well, that's another good question. Even though white minority rule, which was the apartheid system in South Africa, that ended in 1994, about 31 years ago, but some of the effects of apartheid are still being felt in South Africa. The average living standards are far higher for white community in South Africa than for black people.
Yeah.
So white people occupy about 62% of top management jobs in South Africa, but they only account for about 7 to 8% of the country's economically active population. So the fact that only 7 to 8% of the economically active people in South Africa are white, but a whopping 60% or 62% of top management jobs have gone to white South Africans.
Yeah.
So they have a disproportionate presence in terms of top management jobs. So the government of South Africa has tried to change this through what it calls economic empowerment or employment equity laws. And the government has set strict targets for companies in South Africa. These targets are aimed at increasing the number of non-white employees, black people in South Africa. These laws have been welcomed generally by many South Africans, but some members of the white community in South Africa feel these laws make it harder for them to get a government job or a government contract in South Africa.
Yeah, right.
There's also been criticism that these laws can lead to corruption, for example, when business opportunities are given to friends and relatives of officials. And among the critics of this law has been the Democratic Alliance, South Africa's second largest political party, which, despite being part of the government coalition of Cyril Ramaphosa, but the Democratic Alliance recently challenged the Employment Equity Act, which the South African government is trying to promote in courts of law. So it wasn't successful challenging it, but it tried to challenge it in a court of law.
I see. Do most white South African, known as Afrikaners, want to move to the U.S.?
Oh, no, not at all. This is another misconception. Not at all. We mentioned that I think about 70,000 white South Africans have already emigrated from South Africa to the United States because Donald Trump is offering them visas move to the United States. But you have to put that in perspective. The total population of white people in South Africa is about 2.5 million.
I see, yeah.
So there are 2.5 million white South Africans. Out of that 2.5 million, we have about 70,000 white South Africans or Afrikaners have expressed an interest in moving to the United States after Donald Trump's offer of visa to the white South Africans. Yeah. The U.S. Embassy in South Africa has released a statement clarifying that anyone from any racial background, not just Afrikaners, not just white South Africans, but any South African, no matter what their race, could, if they can cite an incident in the past where they can prove persecution or fear of persecution, then they would be given a visa to emigrate to the United States.
Yeah.
But the fact that 70,000 white South Africans have taken up visas and moved to the United States, it doesn't mean that most white South Africans want to leave South Africa and move to the United States, because 70,000 is a small number compared to 2.5 million.
Yeah, exactly right. President Trump also accused the New York Times and the fake news media of not issuing a word against this genocide. Tell us more about that.
Well, there has been, of course, no coverage of the genocide in South Africa by the New York Times or the mainstream U.S. media, CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, because there is no genocide taking place in South Africa.
Right.
It's all in Donald Trump's imagination. Mm. There is no genocide. So that's the simple reason why CBS News, NBC, ABC, CNN, none of them have actually covered this so-called genocide in South Africa. It doesn't actually, it's not real.
Yeah.
It's imaginary.
Thank you, Mr. Dashen, for your insightful analysis.
Thank you very much.
For more on these and other critical issues, be sure to visit our website at parstoday.ar/en. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Join us again next time for another edition of That Was the Week That Was. Take care and goodbye.
watching over you. He's the light of the heavens and earth. He's the first and he is the last. Obey him and always say, La ilaha illallah. Obey him and always say, La ilaha illallah.
Every night and every day.
Every night and every day. Never forget to say,
Good morning to all listeners from around the world. You are tuning to Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. I'm your host for the next hour. Inventions that emerge from the Islamic world include the discovery of Critic acid, Jaber ibn Hayyan, architecture, the minaret, the bridge mill, the vertical axle windmill, teaching hospitals, marching bands, early torpedoes, the guitar, the lute, the water pipe, also known as hookah, early attempts at gliding, algebra, the pinhole camera, the laws of refraction of light in optic, coffee, and more. Muslim scholar Ibn Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes, Kepler, and Isaac Newton. You are listening to the continuation of Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with Round the World with reporters. Reporters from around the world tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from countries both near and afar. After that, we have For a Better Life. The program teaches excellent practical ethics and morals which we can use in our lives from the point of view of Islam. Our varied radio productions feature will be our final program this hour. Stay with us for the next hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Today is the third and final day of that judicial review in this court. It's in fact a legal challenge brought by the direct action group Palestine Action against its prescription by the Labour government in July this year. Last month, the judges heard from the representatives of the Palestine Action group, but today, the final day, the judges are hearing from lawyers representing the Interior Ministry, known to Britons as the Home Office. But here's how we got here.
Set up in 2020, Palestine Action's stated goal is to end global participation in Israel's genocidal and apartheid regime. It's mainly targeted weapons factories, especially those belonging to the Israeli group Elbit Systems. In July this year, activists protesting against Israel's genocidal war on Gaza broke into an Air Force base in southern England, causing, the government claims, more than $9 million in damage to two aircraft. Days later, then-Home Secretary Yvette Cooper declared the group a terrorist entity, effectively making membership or support for the group a criminal offense. The ban took effect in July 5th.
It's a massive, massive overreaction and, frankly, an act of state repression to stop the people from mobilizing in a way that they feel is detrimental to their financial interests.
Seeing this as an attack on their civil liberties, thousands have since come out in a string of rallies, holding up signs reading these words. At least 2,300 have been arrested, more than 200 charged with offenses that carry up to 6 months in prison. Earlier this year, Palestine Action's co-founder, Huda Amouri, requested and won permission for a judicial review of the ban at this court, for the court to see if the ban was lawful, if the Home Office followed the correct procedure before proceeding to prescribe the group. In October, the government tried and failed to block the challenge going ahead. And last month, after days of nationwide sign-holding protests, the judicial review finally began. But at the last minute, Martin Chamberlain, the judge due to hear the legal challenge, was replaced by a panel of three judges without explanation. Two of those replacement judges have links that campaigners say raised the appearance of a conflict of interest.
The case against some of the most formidable foes in the world, the British state, the Israeli state, the weapons industry, these are not people who are going to take this lightly. So it doesn't surprise me that they're willing to sabotage the process.
Dame Victoria has familial links to prominent pro-Israel lobbyist and major Labour Party donor Trevor Chin and the group Quilliam, which has been widely condemned as Islamophobic and for supporting far-right agitator Tommy Robinson. And Justice Jonathan Swift, who dismissed WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange's extradition appeal back in 2023, has represented the Home Office, which is the defendant in this judicial review, on more than one occasion.
A judgment is expected at a later date, but if the judges in this court find in favor of Palestine Action, the group could potentially be deprescribed. The charges against its many supporters will have to be dropped, and not only that, it'll be a huge embarrassment for the British government that the pro-Palestine demonstrators in the country accuse of participation in Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians. Saipur is up, London.
Pakistan's Defense Minister Khwaja Asif has said that Muslim countries should revisit their diplomatic stance on Gaza, arguing that incessant Israeli ceasefire violations have undermined peace efforts. His comments come as several regional governments express frustrations over the failure of internationally backed agreements to halt military operations. Officials in Islamabad say any reassessment would aim to push for a more reliable framework that prevents future breaches. The idea of a collective Muslim response has been gaining traction in recent weeks, particularly as the Gaza humanitarian concerns deepen.
Daily ceasefire violations are occurring by the Israeli forces, and Muslim Ummah needs to be united and have one solution with one voice, but they are not raising their voices against the Israelis.
Countries across West Asia have been consulting one another on possible political steps, including coordinated pressure through regional bodies. Observers say the broader question is whether Muslim-majority states can unify around a position strong enough to influence future negotiations. Pakistan's call reflects a wider debate over the limits of current mediation efforts. They point out any new approach would require consensus among key regional actors and a clearer mechanism for enforcing commitments on all sides and a more sustainable political roadmap for Gaza.
What will Israel do? Will it continue to violate the ceasefire? This is an existential question for all the countries who have agreed to this U.S.-backed solution. How long will they allow Israel to kill innocent Palestinian children? No, they will reconsider.
The debate points to a wider re-evaluation underway throughout the Muslim world, suggesting that Gaza's future may hinge on a new coordinated regional strategy that could reshape the way the conflict is addressed. Khanwa Muhyiddin, Islamabad.
The UN General Assembly officially established International Solidarity Day in 1977 to express its concern about the continuing plight of the Palestinian people.
Despite the ceasefire, it is still an ongoing genocide. So the special thing is we're trying to bring to the attention of the international community about the plight of the Palestinian people, not only the genocide in Gaza, but also the terror of the settlers in the West Bank.
Speakers stressed that the Palestinian people have not yet achieved their inalienable right as defined by the General Assembly, namely the right to self-determination and national independence, among other things.
The occupation has no moral limits, but during the past 2 years, the Palestinian people have shown their resistance, which made Israel a pariah state. This is what we celebrate on this day. The project for Palestinian nationhood will not come to an end because the Arab states support it.
Representatives and ambassadors from dozens of UN member states expressed their support for Palestine, while many criticized UN Security Council for its inaction to end the Gaza genocide. On November 17th, the Security Council adopted Resolution 2803, which endorsed US President Donald Trump's so-called peace plan for Gaza.
The document contains several deeply problematic elements. Israel's obligations as an occupying power, including the renunciation of annexation of Palestinian lands and the withdrawal of its forces, are not enshrined. Resolution 2803, adopted by the UN Security Council, does not vest it with the necessary prerogatives to maintain peace and security.
The United Nations Security Council, which would have the powers and the authority to take coercive measures against such extreme violations of international order and international law, has been paralyzed because what is written in its own charter, namely the veto right. In this particular case of mainly, not only, but mainly, I mean the veto privilege enjoyed by the United States.
The Day of Solidarity at UN concluded with a cultural program featuring the Palestinian choir, Shatat, screenings of Gaza documentaries and Palestinian cuisine.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people at UN headquarters in Vienna concludes a series of events and demonstrations over the past days and weeks. Cultural events, diplomatic meetings and protests were well attended by representatives and people from around the world. However, diplomats from Western states remained largely absent from any shows of solidarity with the Palestinians. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
On the second leg of his first foreign trip as head of the Catholic Church, Pope Leo XIV is in Lebanon for a visit, which he said carries a message of peace.
At times, humanity looks at the Middle East with a sense of trepidation and disheartenment in the face of such complex and long-standing conflicts. Yet in the midst of these struggles, a sense of hopefulness and encouragement can be found when we focus on what unites us, our common humanity, and our belief in a God of love and mercy.
During an interreligious event at Martyrs Square in central Beirut, the Pope listened to representatives from many of Lebanon's 18 officially recognized religious denominations. The Shia cleric asked the Pope to advocate for an end to Lebanon's years-long struggle in the face of Israeli aggression.
We are believers of the significance of the authority of the state, but in its absence, we were forced to defend ourselves and face Israel, which invaded our land. It is not our hobby to take up arms or sacrifice our sons. We therefore put our cause in your hands with what you have of international influence. Perhaps the world can help us out of our crises, primarily the Israeli aggression and its impacts.
Outside the official gatherings, believers await Pope Leo on the main roads to catch a glimpse of the revered figure.
It's a good opportunity to see Pope Leon 14 in our country, and we pray with him for the peace in Lebanon and the Middle East.
The Pope is handling with him a message of peace, a message of love, a message of honor for the country. We are honored to be to him to be with us.
The Pope's recognition of the importance of Lebanon's religious pluralism is considered pivotal, especially at this juncture in time. At the same time, experts believe his visit will most probably not be helpful for Lebanon when it comes to tangible action.
The visit will end within 2 days, and I don't think it will have much impact. We might witness a rise of tension by the Israelis. This is what they have been threatening of. And all we can count on is the capacity of the resistance to ward off threats. We don't have any other option. No calls for peace, no calls for normalization would have any effect with such a ferocious and criminal enemy such as Israel.
During his visit to Beirut, Pope Leo XIV has prayed for peace in Lebanon and the wider region. However, many fear that his visit is merely a show of symbolic solidarity, one that will neither halt the Israeli aggression against Lebanon, nor will it end the wave of U.S. intimidation targeting the political leadership. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
For weeks, tensions in the Caribbean have been intensifying. The latest flashpoint came after President Donald Trump posted on his Truth Social account that Venezuelan airspace should be considered closed in its entirety. Venezuela quickly slammed the move. The country's foreign minister denounced the move, calling it a colonialist threat and an unjustified aggression against the people of Venezuela.
Venezuela denounces and condemns the colonialist threat that seeks to affect the sovereignty of its airspace, constituting an illegal and unjustified aggression against the people of Venezuela.
As tensions rise over Venezuelan airspace, Washington faces mounting criticism abroad and at home. Cuba and Iran join in condemning Washington's posture, but more is expected from neighboring countries whose silence so far has raised questions about how the region will respond to escalating U.S.-Venezuela tensions.
But, you know, I think most of the pressure lays on the shoulders of the neighboring countries, and that's to say Brazil, and that's to say also Colombia.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer issued a sharp warning accusing President Trump of reckless actions that could push America into another costly foreign war. He said, Americans are tired of endless foreign wars that cost the lives of countless American service members and drain precious resources. So what is Washington's goal? The U.S. claims its actions are aimed at fighting cartels and drug trafficking. But analysts argue the real objective is to force Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from power, either through pressure or the threat of military force.
And so there's a lot already in the region, and if there's even more on top of that, then one would think either that capability is going to be used, or it's all sort of trying to demonstrate to President Maduro that it's either you leave the regime now and perhaps dictate some terms that are somewhat agreeable, or there will be a full-scale military operation to unseat you.
The U.S. has a long history of intervention in Latin America and the Caribbean, from Panama to El Salvador to Cuba. Critics say the latest pressure campaign against Venezuela fits that pattern, with troops already positioned in the Caribbean and rhetoric heating up. This standoff is no longer just about Venezuela's skies. It's about whether America is prepared to risk a wider conflict in its own backyard.
Crowds filled the 70 square of the Yemeni capital to mark Eid al-Jalal, Yemen's national day celebrating the official end of British rule over South Yemen. What was once a commemoration of the historic liberation has become a platform for Yemenis to reaffirm their opposition to all forms of modern-day foreign occupation. Demonstrators waved pro-resistance flags and chanted slogans against any external interference, emphasizing that the spirit that drove the British out still shapes Yemen's national identity. Former Yemeni Prime Minister Abdelaziz bin Habtoud addressed the rally, condemning Saudi Arabia and the UAE for their interference in Yemen.
Today we are in a battle against the Saudi occupier, who is occupying parts of our lands, and also against the Emirates, who is occupying our islands and provinces. The people who came out today are sending a defiant message to the government that we are ready to defend every ounce of our land.
The main theme of the rally directed strong words at foreign-backed groups inside Yemen.
We came out today to tell the mercenaries and the agents that your end is near, and we are waiting for the orders to fight you and drive you out along with the Saudis and the Emirates.
Tribal leaders also used the occasion to express solidarity with regional resistance movements.
On this side, al-Jalal, the day our people expelled the last British soldier, we send a message to our brothers in Iran, Hezbollah, and the resistance in Palestine that we are with you. Your enemy is our enemy, and we will never forsake you no matter the challenges we face.
For Yemenis in Sana'a, Eid al-Jalal remains both a reminder of past liberation and a renewed vow to confront any attempts at occupation in Yemen.
The protesters have delivered a clear message. Yemenis will not allow their country to fall under any form of occupation, nor will they tolerate any mercenary forces operating on behalf of foreign powers. Yusuf Audi, Sana'a.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
Farmud bo'istu lu'utammima makarim al-akhlaq.
The Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. The world is a guest house. The wise man doesn't build his home where he will not stay. Peace and blessings, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Nahid, having the honor of hosting you on another journey through the worlds and wisdom on For a Better Life. Today, we speak of a truth that visits every heart, yet few hearts welcome it, the truth of death. Not to sadden us, but to awaken us. Not to steal our joy, but to deepen it. For death is not an end. It is a mirror reflecting how we have lived. Sadi Shirazi, the Persian prose writer and poet, would say, "He who lives purely dies peacefully." Most people do not fear death itself. They fear leaving behind what they have not lived rightly. We fear unfinished business, unspoken love, and unoffered forgiveness. Imam Ali alayhi salam once said, "People are asleep. When they die, they awaken." The fear of death often hides the fear of truth. It whispers, "What if I wasted my chance?" But faith answers, "Then start now." Sadi tells a story. A man wept when his candle went out. The wise said, "Weep not. It was meant to light only this night." Every soul, like that candle, is meant to shine for a time, to bring warmth, to guide, to love. And when its flame returns to the wind, it is not loss. It is reunion. So why mourn the wind that takes the light back to its source? Allah says in the Holy Book of Quran, "Indeed, we belong to Allah, and to Him we shall return." Return, not vanish. Transition, not extinction. Death is simply the door that opens from the seen to the unseen. Imam Ali alayhi salam had said, "The world is behind you, and the hereafter ahead. Each has its children. Be one of the children of the hereafter. The wise one lives in this world, but for the next." Now, when we remember death, we don't become gloomy. We should become grateful. We speak more kindly, we forgive faster, and we value the moments we once wasted. Sadi wrote, "The leaf knows it will fall, yet it dances in the wind." So to live well is not to live forever. It is to live aware, grateful, and gentle. The same story happens to us. When we remember death, we usually, like for a few days, if we keep remembering and reminding ourselves, we'll be kinder, we know that everything shall pass, so we try to forgive other people easier, we will be more generous with the other people, and these little changes, believe me, my friends, are those moments that we are understanding the value of death, the value of the hereafter, and we're trying to, say, be the children of the hereafter. Now, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam prays in this way, "O Lord, make me fear you as if I see you, and grant me the certainty that brings comfort in death." Faith doesn't erase death, it makes it meaningful, because the believer knows that after every sunset, there is the dawn. After every farewell, there is the reunion. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, before the battlefield of Karbala, said, "Death is but a bridge that connects the beloved to the beloved." Such words can only come from a heart that has seen the truth behind the veil. That is why in the moment of his martyrdom, he remembered and he saw the beauty of the hereafter. He was assured from before that what he's going to see is nothing of the pain, nothing of the darkness, but rather the thing that he had been working for, the thing that he had been wanting for a long time. Sadi Shirazi warns, "He who builds palaces upon sand shall see them swallowed by the tide." When we forget death, we live as if we are eternal here. We become arrogant, restless, greedy. We chase shadows and call them treasures. But remembering death humbles us, anchors us, and makes every small good deed feel sacred. Now, let's go for a short break, and then we're going to be back by the rest of this thoughtful episode on death.
ارتباطتون رو با خدا قوی کنید. در مسائل دینی به نقاط عقلانی و ظریف.
Improve your connection with God. Pay attention to logical and detailed points in religious issues and learn them from great masters. There are sentiments in religion, but they rely on deep ideality and deep thought. This thought must be learned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Welcome back to For a Better Life, the episode that makes us remember death as the door to the hereafter and as the eyes, the lens that can help us see the place that we were promised to and the place that we should want to enter. Now, there are two wrong ways of looking at the death. The first one is to live careless of death or to live paralyzed by it. Well, the middle path is awareness. I mean, some people usually are trying to be careless of death and they want to just ignore it as if it doesn't exist. And the other ones are paralyzed by it. But what our religion is showing us is this balance between the two ideas. Our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam had said, "Remember often the destroyer of pleasures, death, for it purifies the heart. It's like sharpening a blade. You don't break it, you prepare it." Sa'di once described a proud king who built a grand palace beside a cemetery. He said to his minister, "Whenever pride rises in me, I look out the window and see who once thought they owned the world." That king, Sa'di, ruled by justice until his last breath, for the grave was his teacher. Now, today, we hide from death, sometimes, and mistakenly. We don't speak of it, we disguise it behind comfort and distraction. But this silence weakens our soul. True peace comes when we face what we cannot avoid and find the meaning in it. If we lived as if every breath mattered, would we still waste words in anger? Would we still turn away from those in need? Of course not. Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam had said, "The best death is the one that finds you doing good." A good death is not about the way one dies, but the way one lives. It means being ready, heart clean, words kind, soul aware. As Sa'di beautifully mentions, "Happy is he who departs this world before the world departs from his heart." Now, how do we prefer? Not by fearing, but by doing. Being honest when it costs us. Being gentle when we could be harsh. Being charitable when no one sees. Praying not out of habit, but out of love. Forgiven, because Allah forgives us every day. Every act of good is a seed for the next life, and every intention a lantern for our grave. Now, the believer's heart whispers, "Death cannot take what I have given to God." Everything we do sincerely stays. Our love, our kindness, our prayer, our patience. All of it waits to welcome us in the hereafter. As Sa'di wrote, "The fruit of this garden is not eaten here. The wise people plant for a season yet to come." When Imam Ali alayhi salam was struck, he said calmly, "By the Lord of the Kaaba, I have succeeded." That was not arrogance, it was relief. He had lived prepared. If we walk through life trying to see Allah's hand in all things, then death is not darkness. It is merely the end of a sentence before a new paragraph begins. Now, dear listeners, death is not our enemy. Neglect is. It is not the loss of breath that ends a person. It is the loss of purpose. Let us live fully, love deeper, and leave the world lighter than we found it. And when the time comes to return, may our heart whisper what Sa'di once did. "I did not come to say, I came to pass the message of love and go." Live gratefully and die beautifully. May every step you take be toward light, and may your soul rest always in peace and purpose. Until another time on For a Better Life, we wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there. Be there.
I'm a traveler, just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past, on an earth so vast, waiting to return. Just to know you, whoever you are, laugh with you, learn from you, open to you my heart. But soon when I say goodbye and move on, I'm a traveler, just as they were, walking the world, thinking of the past, on an earth so vast, waiting to return. While I'm here, I will always try to be.
While I'm here, I will always try to be.
The kind of neighbor who prays for you and me.
The kind of neighbor who prays for you and me.
There for you,
a shoulder to
turn to. I'm a traveler, just as they were,
walking
the world, thinking of the past, on an earth so vast,
waiting
to return, waiting to return. Pleasure to know you, I've learned so much.
Been a pleasure to know you, I've learned so much.
Pray for you, hope to meet you, my heart you have touched.
Pray for you, hope to meet you, my heart you have touched.
Remember me, so I might be with you. I'm a traveler, just as they were,
walking
the world, thinking of the past, on an earth so vast,
waiting
to return, waiting to return, waiting to return, return to my
May peace, mercy, and God's blessings be upon you. However, if you do not comply and intentionally delay, we testify that with God's assistance, we will invade your land by force. We will declare war on you using all means and methods at our disposal. We will bring you under the yoke and obedience of the church and their majesties. We will capture you, your wives, and your children, reducing you to slavery. Then we will sell you off and dispose of you as ordered by their majesties. We will confiscate your property and inflict as much harm and damage as possible on those who resist accepting their rightful master. We warn you that the resulting deaths and losses will be solely your responsibility, not that of their majesties, nor ours, nor of these knights accompanying us. In the early 16th century, specifically after 1510, Spanish conquerors arrived on the shores of the New World, which would later be known as America. They recited this text, part of which I have just quoted, called the Requerimiento, a term that suggests a request. Read in Latin to indigenous peoples who did not understand the language, its aim was not to communicate, but to legitimize future violence. This justification was aimed at the invaders themselves. It served as a certificate of impunity granted to criminals before they committed their crimes. With this document, the Spanish conquerors declared that the indigenous peoples, labeled as barbarians, had to submit to the Kingdom of Spain and the Pope of the Catholic Church. They were to surrender and convert to Christianity or otherwise take full responsibility for their fate. These were communities living on their own lands, posing no threat to Spain, Europe, or the Pope in Rome, and who were even unaware of their existence. Yet Spain and the Church claimed the right to massacre, enslave, and destroy their societies while blaming the victims for their own extermination. This colonial mindset, which dehumanizes the colonized, blames them for the crimes committed against them, and justifies their subjugation, is not a relic of the past. It's a policy that remains in effect today. In the conflict against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip during the years 2023, 2024, and 2025, we have heard chilling echoes of the logic of the Requerimiento. The policy adopted by the occupying entity was articulated by Israeli President Isaac Herzog, who stated that all Palestinians in Gaza, without exception, were responsible for the attack on October 7th. He also stated that there were no innocent civilians in the area. Everyone was involved. Since then, a campaign has been launched to blame the Palestinian people, the forces that chose to confront the occupation, and those who supported them. Victims of all crimes committed by the occupying entity are now being held accountable. This process often begins with the collective demonization of the victims. The clearest expression of this policy was given by Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Yoav Gallant, immediately after October 7th, when he referred to Gazans as human animals and imposed a total blockade that denied them water, food, and electricity. This tone has been repeatedly heard throughout colonial history. Labels such as savages and barbarians were applied to indigenous populations to justify their persecution and extermination. In their official documents, for instance, the Spanish described the nations they invaded as barbaric, while the British branded the resistance fighters in their colonies as savages. Colonial policy throughout the centuries has been based on three fundamental principles: dehumanizing the inhabitants